You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda. I'm an editor at The Diplomat, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Shannon Tiezi, our editor focused on all things China. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
Shannon and I are going to discuss recent developments in Japan-China relations on this week's podcast. Always an interesting topic and something that we write about regularly at The Diplomat. Relations between Tokyo and Beijing haven't been great. And that particularly began with Japan's decision to nationalize the Senkaku Jiayu Islands in mid-2012. Those islands are disputed between the two countries, although Japan doesn't acknowledge a dispute there. And China claims the islands, Japan administers them. And basically, since Japan nationalized those islands in 2012, relations have been very bad. I should note that the islands were actually nationalized under Japan's previous government. And so if you read a lot about Japan-China relations these days, it seems like a lot of it has to do with Beijing's problems with Abe, the Japanese prime minister, who's a known right-wing nationalist. And of course, while the Chinese leadership does not like Abe, it should be noted that the DPJ, the Democratic Party of Japan, when they were in power, the nationalization decision was made back then. And there's actually a whole interesting story about why they did that. It had to do with, you know, preventing the islands from ending up under the possession of a far more nationalistic person than Shinzo Abe even. But anyways, over the past 2 years, Shannon and I have been covering Japan-China relations quite a bit. And it's remarkable. It seems like we're actually getting to a point where things are looking up a bit. From the nationalization of the islands through most of 2014, the East China Sea appeared to be the hot flashpoint. Obviously, these days, we talk a lot about the South China Sea. A few of the previous podcast episodes have been about that dispute, which has really started to heat up over the past year. But there was a time when the topics that we were talking about as hot issues in Asian security included China's air defense identification zone in the East China Sea, possible conflict around the Senkaku Jiayu Islands. But in recent months, that has kind of calmed down a bit. And a lot of that has to do with efforts that have been made by the Japanese leadership to improve relations with China. That culminated actually last November with a four-point consensus that senior negotiators from both sides arrived at as a basis on which to resume Japan-China diplomacy. And I'll just go through those points very briefly and then pass it over to Shannon to talk a bit about the recent developments. So the 4 points, essentially. The first was that China and Japan agreed to continue to develop a mutually beneficial relationship based on common strategic interests. Okay, that's diplo speak. We're used to that. The second issue was that they reached some agreement, some recognition on the difficulties that exist, especially the issues of history. And history is something that we can talk about a bit as well, Shannon, since this is the 70th anniversary of the end of the war in Asia, and China's looking to celebrate that with great fanfare next month. And the third point in this consensus was regarding the dispute over the Senkaku Jiayu Islands. Now, as I said, Japan doesn't acknowledge the dispute, but China did manage to sort of get a concession out of Tokyo where they agreed that different positions exist on the dispute and they will work to manage tensions. Currently, there's also a process between the two countries to set up a maritime crisis management framework. And the fourth final point was that they both agreed to gradually resume political, diplomatic, and security dialogues, which is where we come to now. So Shannon, can you tell us a bit about this meeting that took place on the 18th, I believe, between Shotaro Yachi, the head of Japan's National Security Council, an institution that was founded once Abe returned to power, and Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiechi?
Sure. So in the context of what you just told us, I think it's important to note that Yang Jiechi and Shotaro Yachi were actually the two leaders who negotiated the four-point consensus in the first place. And it was announced at a meeting between the two of them back in November 2014. So that gives you a little bit of background. Their last meeting was very productive and a breakthrough in China-Japan relations. This meeting was also fairly positive, although there was some interesting sort of background context that I'll get into a little bit later. The main points of this meeting, from all indications, was that China wanted to talk with Japan in advance of Shinzo Abe's August 15th statement on the 70th anniversary of World War II. They're very interested in seeing that statement before Abe actually reads it out, having their input heard and hopefully having Japan issue a statement that China is comfortable with. The other thing that's on the agenda is the possibility of a bilateral Xi Jinping-Shinzo Abe summit. We've had a couple of meetings between Xi and Abe before, most notably at the APEC summit in Beijing last fall, but they've all come on the sidelines of multilateral meetings. We haven't seen a one-on-one, purely bilateral summit, which would be huge, a huge step forward for the China-Japan relationship. What's interesting is that Shinzo Abe has been fairly eager for this summit as a sign that he hasn't mishandled the relationship with China, which is something that his critics have argued. But right now, it's actually China who's eager to have Shinzo Abe come visit because they want him present at the September 3rd celebration of China's victory in the war against a people's resistance against the Japanese aggression, which is the long name that China uses for their war that overlapped with World War II, but actually began a bit earlier when Japan officially invaded China. So for obvious reasons, Shinzo Abe is a little reluctant to take part in a military parade celebrating the defeat of his country 70 years ago and listening to speech after speech about the horrible atrocities his government committed. But he is considering visiting China either before or after the September 3rd date. And according to diplomatic sources reporting in Japanese media, Yang and Yachi sort of reached an agreement that said China would consider such a visit by Shinzo Abe if three conditions were met. One is that Japan sticks to the four-point consensus, which you outlined earlier, Ankit. Two is that Abe follows in the spirit of the Moriyama Statement, which refers to the statement issued in 1995 on the 50th anniversary of the end of the war that contains some crucial language about apologizing for Japan's colonialism and aggression against other countries. And the third condition is that Abe promises not to pay any more visits to the Yasukuni Shrine, which caused a major rift in China-Japan relations back in December 2013. So that definitely paves the way for a summit, although I will note that the first two conditions are completely open to China's interpretation. Anytime Japan does something that China doesn't like, China says, oh, you need to stick to the four-point consensus, you're violating it. It's pretty vague stuff, especially the first point about them working together for a steady bilateral relationship. So almost anything that Japan does that China views negatively could, in theory, be seen as a rationale for saying, well, you violated our conditions and we're not having this summit anymore.
Right. And I have something in mind that I think will satisfy that condition, which is obviously the East China Sea exclusive economic zone issue. We can get to that in a bit. I do think it's interesting that China is emphasizing the Murayama statement, since Murayama politically is so different from Abe. I mean, so for listeners who might not know, Murayama was Prime Minister of Japan from 1994 to 1996, and he was actually one of the few leaders of the country not from the Liberal Democratic Party. He was from the Japanese Socialist Party, and he's widely regarded as one of the Japanese leaders in recent history who's been the most remorseful for Japan's historical acts. Also, there's an interesting history there with Moriyama and how he views the comfort women issue with South Korea. And speaking of South Korea, Shannon, I wanted to ask you a bit about this parallel diplomatic process that's occurring in Northeast Asia trilaterally. We had a foreign ministers meeting between the foreign ministers, ministers of South Korea, Japan, and China, and we heard murmurings that this could lead up to a leader summit. And from what I gather, it seems like Japan would prefer to maybe broach the leaders issue with the with this trilateral summit initially, and then move on to a Xi Abe summit, especially if that means that Abe can avoid this September 3rd issue. What's your perception about this parallel trilateral process that's going on with South Korea included?
The trilateral process is interesting because for a while it was moving more quickly than the bilateral China-Japan relationship. You were having more trilateral meetings, security talks, finance talks, economic talks, than you were having on the purely China-Japan bilateral side. That seems to have changed a little bit. We've seen a pickup in the pace of China-Japan bilateral talks. And on the security front, it seems like they're getting close to their kind of conflict management mechanism that would let the established communication procedures for an unexpected run-in in the East China Sea. I think really this history issue in the China-Japan-Korea trilateral is a sticking point. And as strange as it may seem, I think there's been more progress on that bilaterally in the China-Japan side than on the Japan-Korea side. And I'll give you an example. So South Korea had a group of former forced laborers who were more or less enslaved by these Japanese corporations during the war and forced to work for the war effort, who sued Mitsubishi in court, demanding compensation for their labor and for all that they went through during that time. And they won, and Mitsubishi appealed the verdict, and it was upheld by the court. And on the other side of things, you have a group of Chinese forced laborers who sued Mitsubishi. And it was just announced today by the Chinese representative of that group that Mitsubishi has agreed to formally apologize, to issue 100,000 renminbi compensation to each of the people who brought the suit, which includes forced laborers themselves and also the family members of those who have passed on, and also to establish a monument to commemorate the plight of the victims, you know, sort of the ultimate step towards legitimizing their stories and saying, yes, this happened, and yes, we're sorry, and we're acknowledging this history. And that comes after Mitsubishi also formally apologized to U.S. forced laborers in the U.S. So this has created a weird situation where Mitsubishi has apologized to Chinese forced laborers, apologized to American forced laborers, and yet is counterattacking in court the need to compensate and apologize to Korean forced laborers. You also had this huge issue with Japan seeking UNESCO World Heritage Site recognition for industrial sites that, again, had this forced labor issue with them, and Korea very strongly being opposed to that. And I don't know if those concerns were addressed as much as Koreans would like them to. There hasn't been as much movement on the comfort women issue as many Koreans would like. So it may be that at this point, Korea is more concerned about history issues than China is. And that's what's holding back the trilateral process as opposed to the Japan-China bilateral process.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, now that we've talked a bit about the opportunities for closer relations between Japan and China, let's talk a bit about the threats. Notably, Japan's defense posture has been shifting gradually ever since Abe returned in December 2012. You know, Japan set up a National Security Council, set up a new national security law, and just a couple weeks ago, a package of national security laws were voted through the upper house, leading to the largest protests in Tokyo that have been seen since the Fukushima reactor meltdown incident. In the defense white paper that was recently released, the Japanese defense ministry spends a ton of words talking about China's behavior in the region and how that is being perceived as a major threat. Concurrently, we also have this issue of the exclusive economic zones in the East China Sea. So for listeners, just as a way of background, the East China Sea, which is roughly north of Taiwan, bounded by the first island chain, the Ryukyu Islands, leading up to Japan, and the Yellow Sea in the north, is disputed by Japan, China, and South Korea. And in particular, the Japanese and Chinese exclusive economic zone boundaries overlap a series of highly valuable gas fields. And currently what is happening is that Japan and China have kind of set this aside a bit, and Japan has pushed for a recognition of the geographic equidistance line, which essentially estimates the middle area between the two continental shelves. But basically, recently the Japanese Foreign Ministry released a statement showing that China has set up, I believe it was 12, Shannon, or 14?
They said 16, but they didn't give all the locations of these structures in the documentation they provided.
Okay, some teens of of Chinese gas platforms, and these are being set up. China's conducting gas exploration work, and all of these are on the Chinese side of the equidistance line, but the issue is touchy for Japan because the gas reserves extend over to the Japanese side of the equidistance line, and there's a possibility that China could, you know, end up tapping into resources that Japan should be, you know, should have access to. And there is a 2008 agreement between the two countries where they set aside a bounded area between a few coordinates that is that has been allocated for joint resource development. So, you know, all of these issues, the East China Sea issue, the national security law, the defense white paper, just if you take this all together, it does show that the domestic political debate in Japan is still very much hyping the China threat in a way. And there is great potential for this to derail any rapprochement that is occurring between Beijing and Tokyo. So Shannon, how is China viewing all of these things? Can you tell us a bit about the Chinese reaction to the white paper, to this East China Sea issue? What is the Chinese perspective here?
To all three of these things that you've mentioned, China has reacted quite negatively and quite predictably to anyone who follows Chinese foreign policy pronouncements. All of the language is exactly what you expect, that Japan is hyping the China threat, that Japan is being two-faced and, you know, seeking to repair China's ties, but then also passing national security laws that help upgrade its military, and then also having a defense white paper that targets China as a major threat to Japanese security. So China is very not happy about this. And it does raise an interesting question about timing on the Japanese side. I think the security legislation has been in the works for a long time, and that's not going anywhere. It's been one of Shinzo Abe's major priorities since he took office. But the timing of doing that and then issuing a defense white paper that makes it clear that China is Japan's greatest security threat, which then implies that these defense reforms undertaken by Japan are in fact aimed at China, although Japan has insisted that they're not. And then on top of that, having this weird East China Sea dispute just coming back into full force when it had been kind of, you know, lying low in public attention. It's very strange, and I think you're right to point to domestic political factors in Japan as being a root cause. Media reports have suggested that the original defense white paper wasn't quite as harsh on China. It probably had some strong language in there, but it wasn't harsh enough, according to LDP lawmakers, and they actually said, we're not going to approve this until you put some more stuff in there on the East China Sea. So then Japan's Ministry of Defense did that. And then once they did that, I think the Ministry of Foreign Affairs felt that they had to release the documentation backing up these charges because it seemed like such an odd thing to do. And everyone was saying, well, where are these structures? Well, what are these structures? You know, we don't have any evidence of them. So then they had to release the evidence. And this whole thing kind of stems back to a group of Chinese domestic politicians thinking that Japan needed to take a harder line on China, which may not have been what the actual people in the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Foreign Affairs wanted to do. Now, that being said, I think it's important to kind of separate out the discrete issues in China-Japan relations, the history issue, the East China Sea dispute, all of these very specific potential flashpoints, and then the grander geopolitical competition where Japan looks at China's rise and says, that's a threat to us, and we need to do something to counter this threat, whether that's, you know, deterrence on a security field or increasing our political, diplomatic, economic presence in regions where China is also very active, such as Southeast Asia. And then China is also looking at Japan and saying, you know, 70 years ago, Japan was our greatest enemy, and Japan remilitarizing is in some ways China's worst nightmare. Japan's also a security ally of the U.S., so there's a lot of insecurity in Beijing about what that means, and a tendency to read everything Japan does is somehow orchestrated behind the scenes by Washington to Beijing's detriment. So right. Even if you say, okay, history issue somehow solved, East China Sea issue is somehow solved, there's still going to be this competition. And you look at China and the U.S., they don't have this historical baggage. They don't have an actual territorial dispute, and the relationship is still pretty bad and getting worse, actually, many observers feel. So these aren't issues that are going to go away because of this grand geopolitical competition. Really won't let them go away.
Yeah, and I think I just saw yesterday that Abe will actually head to Central Asia, and he'll be the first Japanese prime minister to do so since the mid-2000s. And as some listeners might know, Central Asia has been a a hotbed for Chinese investment and attention recently. So Japan, Abe is going to go there, and he's expected to contribute, commit a ton of overseas development assistance, Japanese infrastructure funding for these Central Asian countries in a bid to shore up Japanese influence there. So it's definitely interesting, and you're right that there is this whole underlying geopolitical these geopolitical impulses and dynamics that are also coloring this relationship. You know, just to go back to the issue of the domestic politics and the East China Sea issue, you know, one of the things that I seized on in the article I wrote where I said, hey, this is maybe, you know, not the kind of threat that the Japanese government wants us to think it is, especially compared to what China is doing in the South China Sea, was when the Japanese defense minister, Gen Nakatani, he went before the Diet and he hyped these gas platforms, saying that China could use them to stage drone operations, use them for radar surveillance, use them to land helicopters. And this was really an attempt to convince legislators and convince the Japanese public that, look, China is clearly doing things that threaten our national security, so we need to be, you know, passing these laws that should help our country become a more normal country when it comes to the use of a military. But, you know, like I outlined in that article, I think a lot of these claims are a little bit overblown. I mean, China flies drones over the East China Sea. That's true, but it does so from the mainland, where it has an airbase devoted to its drones, and it has Coast Guard ships with radars on them conducting surveillance in the East China Sea. So why on earth would it need to use gas platforms? So that's a little bit of a, you know, I think a little bit of a red herring from the defense minister there. But yeah, there are definitely all of these complicating factors in this relationship. So Shannon, overall, I guess let's conclude this podcast. What is your, you know, overall sense? I guess you can either give it a letter grade or give it a score out of 10, let's say, the overall state of the Japan-China relationship. What would you say?
Oh man. I would say right now it's at maybe a 5 out of 10, you know. It's neither good nor bad. And that in itself is actually a huge improvement from what we saw throughout 2013 and 2014, when the relationship was actively bad. I mean, now you have political talks, you're having high-level meetings. The possibility of a top-level meeting is at least being discussed, which is something that would have been unthinkable back in 2014, particularly right after Abe visited the Yasukuni Shrine. But I think we might have reached a point in China-Japan relationships where the famous saying about U.S.-China relationships is true, where the relationship can only be so bad because of the important economic and even political places where the countries need to cooperate. But it can also only be so good because of all of these issues where there's just inherent strategic competition going on between the two countries. So what we're probably going to see from here on out in the China-Japan relationship is what we see in the U.S.-China relationship, which is an uneasy balancing act where the two countries are trying to figure out how they can sort of quarantine their major areas of competition, especially the East China Sea disputes, and not have that spill over to affect the other areas where they need to cooperate. And I think that's what they're doing right now, and they've been fairly successful to date. But the tendency to want to bring these issues into the spotlight, which I think Japan is really trying to capitalize on the immense media attention that the South China Sea has received, and they're trying to get some sort of residual public support, be, oh, China's bad in the South China Sea, therefore China must be bad in the East China Sea, and we should support Japan. But as you've noted, if you actually look at their case, it's really not all that convincing. So I think it's kind of detrimental to them on a public opinion standpoint internationally. And it also it has the tendency to maybe jeopardize the progress being made in the China-Japan relationship, because it brings this issue that had sort of died down right back into the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your rating. I think I'd agree with you. About a 5 out of 10. I guess, I don't know, maybe a B- C+. That translates to if I decided to do a letter grade. But, you know, I also think that the timing of our podcast today is a little bit interesting, since, you know, we're doing it between, you know, this meeting between Yachi and Yang and the passage of the national security laws. But, you know, it'd be interesting to revisit this issue in early September, when the upper house in Japan's Diet will be voting on the national security law package, when we'll know if Abe or any senior Japanese representatives will go to the September 3rd celebrations in Beijing, what the Abe statement will have turned out to be. So I really think, Shannon, that we should revisit this topic in a podcast a couple months from now.
Yeah, and obviously after Abe gives his statement on August 15th, that's going to have huge ramifications for China-Japan and Japan-Korea relationships. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, hey, speaking of August 15th, I'll just recount a personal anecdote. So I think this was the first time I went to Japan, but it was August 15th that I found myself actually at the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo, and that's actually in the heart of Tokyo. And it was remarkable because when I was there, there were all these nationalists protesting, and I was just a little bit caught off guard since, you know, I was kind of just discovering Tokyo as a tourist. But, you know, I'm curious to see how the public opinion reaction will be in Tokyo after the Abe statement, since public opinion for Abe right now is a really dicey topic. He really, you know, his approval ratings are an all-time low over this term after the passage of the national security law in the lower house. So I think that'll again be something that we'll want to keep our eyes on, because as we've said on this podcast, domestic politics in Japan, public opinion, all of these things will also have an effect on Japan's foreign relations and certainly its relations with China.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Shannon, thanks a lot for joining me. Enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, Ankit. I'll talk to you again soon.